As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Now, with the Secretary of Labor here on a jobs day in the shock of good employment, our John Farrell.
I'm Jonathan Farrow. I'm pleased to say that joining us now from Washington is the U.S. Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh. Secretary Walsh, fantastic to catch up with you, sir. Another strong jobs report. As you know, this has been a very, very strong labor market in America, and labor is meant to have the leverage in this world. And Secretary Walsh, we've got to go to the union question. Should unions have the right to strike?
Absolutely, unions have the right to strike. I think unions have the right to strike in almost every collective bargaining agreement. In this particular case, your next question will probably be about the rail, so I'm going to anticipate it. The National Railway Act has a provision in it that allows the president to get involved in negotiation when asked, and the unions asked him to get involved in this. He put together a presidential emergency board. They came back with some recommendations. I had that 20-hour negotiation in my office. We added some more benefits to the contract. It went in front of the members. Eight of the unions voted for it, four of the unions voted against it. I tried to get both sides to stay at the table and negotiate over sick time, and there's some work condition rules as well. They weren't able to get to an agreement, and the next step in the Railway Act is Congress to take action, and that's what they did yesterday.
Well, I'm pleased you anticipated it, because you said it all at once for us. On the one hand, you think they should have the right to strike, and on the other hand, you take away their right to strike. Can you make sense of that for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the way the law is, the Railway Act is. And, you know, when I look at this contract, I spent a lot of time myself, but the unions in particular spent a lot of time at the negotiating table. And there's some very good provisions in the contract. It wasn't like it was a bad contract. 24% increase, 85-15% split on health care, which they preserved. They were able to get some work rules changes. They were able to get three unpaid days off. The issue of sick time needs to be the companies need to sit down with the unions now and have a serious conversation about two issues. One is sick days, paid sick days, and the second issue is manpower and power on the rails. They're down about 30% over the last several years, and that's a big issue when it comes to the safety and health of the workers on the job. So I'm going to encourage both sides now to get right back at it and have those conversations now and move forward in a positive way.
Secretary Walsh, there is a key distinction. An important distinction to make here. It is the way the law can work. It's not necessarily the way the law has to work. You've chosen to make this decision, haven't you? This was a choice.
Well, I think there was a lot of factors here, too. You're talking about the economy, and you're talking about supply chain, and we've had challenges in our country with shortage of baby formula. We've gone through a pandemic where we had shortage of supplies coming in, and what this would have done to the American people, never mind the American economy, it would have crippled a lot of people because we wouldn't have food. It would have shortened food on the shelves, supplies coming in. This is also as much of making sure that our economy and the American people move forward than anything else, too. So, again, I'm very sympathetic to the workers out there, and that's why the president, when he, at their request, put the presidential emergency board together, came back with a very good recommendations on behalf, not everything, but in negotiations. I've negotiated contracts where I've gotten good contracts. I've negotiated contracts where I haven't gotten everything I've wanted either.
Paid sick leave. It's something you have. It's something that I have. How can those railway workers ever secure the benefits that you claim to support without the credible threat to strike?
Well, I hope you have the companies on this show and ask them that same question and not ask me today after the Congress took action yesterday, because I think that's a very important question. You need to ask the companies why that's not offered to their employees across the board. But in saying that, I intend on sitting down with the companies and talking to them about a couple of things that during the negotiations that I heard from the unions about the concerns that they had about their workers have. And I intend on bringing that up and talking to them about it. And in the next contract, this contract expires 2024, so they're already working 3 years without a contract. So as they head into the next negotiation, this should be the top priority. And you don't have to wait for a negotiation. The companies can offer up paid sick time anytime they want.
Oh, you've just made it even easier in the next negotiations, though, haven't you? Because we know the end game here. If you're on the other side deal, that negotiation, Secretary Walsh, why on earth would a company sign up to any of that stuff when we know what's going to happen here? Ultimately, they can just say no, and then it comes to the president, and the president says, okay, we'll impose this deal on you.
No, you know how negotiations work. That's not how it works. I mean,
I've just seen how it's played out, sir, in the last couple of months. What do you mean that's not how it works? That's how it's played out.
That's not how it works. The Congress has interacted over 18 times with a PEB recommendation. In 1992, they recommended a PEB. Congress enforced a PEB that was not pro-worker at all. It didn't have wage increases, didn't have preservation of health care premiums. It didn't have work conditions. It didn't have unpaid days off. It didn't have any of that. And Congress came in. And again, this stuff has to happen at the bargaining table. And that's why the companies need to come to the bargaining table a lot earlier. In this particular case, they didn't come to the table till I think 18 months after the contract expired.
And they won.
And we've had they're going to have to. I think that they you know, a lot of the CEOs have made comments already about the need to better relations with their workers in the unions on their jobs.
Secretary Walsh, you and I can go back and forth on this a lot. The president of the United States intended to be, quote, what he said, his words, the most pro-union president leading to the most pro-union administration in American history. The fact of the matter is, when it came down to it, you forced union members to take a contract they didn't vote for. How do you explain this in any other way, shape, or form? I just don't understand it.
The president of the United States of America is very pro-union. There's no question about it. He talks about it very publicly, and he's very proud of that. He's also the president of the United States of America. And when you look at what the devastation a national rail strike would cause America, that far outweighs the cost of moving forward. The president put together a PEB. There's a lot of benefits in that PEB, good provisions in that PEB that are going to benefit these union workers out there. And there's no question about that. I'm a union worker, a union member myself. I understand that. And at the end of the day, the president got a very good deal on the table for the workers. However, the workers wanted more in that deal, and I can understand and sympathize with the workers. But what we'll do is we're going to continue to work now as an administration to make sure that we help them achieve their ultimate goal.
What message do you think this sends to the ongoing labor contract talks with West Coast dock workers, Secretary Walsh?
I mean, the West Coast dock workers, they're in current negotiation, and they have their own bargaining issues that they're working on, and they're moving forward on that issue. They're having those conversations, those dialogues. The difference is the companies in the dock workers came to the table at the beginning of the negotiation, not halfway through it.
You've been quite constructive on how these talks will go on the West Coast. What are the lessons learned, Secretary Walsh, from the last couple of months with the railroad workers, where you were also equally constructive on how this would turn out? What are the lessons learned for you personally over the last several months?
Unfortunately, for the rail unions, I didn't really get involved until pretty much they were 80% through negotiations, meaning they were not able to get deals done. I got involved a little bit there. Then the unions came and asked the president to put the PEB on the board, and they were able to negotiate stuff. And on the port negotiation, I've been in it from the beginning, meaning I've had conversations with the companies. I'm in regular contact with the companies on the West Coast. I'm in regular contact with the unions on the West Coast just to make sure that they're moving forward. And I think that the relationships are a little different than between the rail companies and the rail workers' unions.
Secretary Walsh, I know you have to go, sir, because there's a bill to sign with the President of the United States at 10:15 Eastern Time, and you've got to run. We always appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us this Friday morning.
Thank you.
Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, following what was a tremendous jobs report.
John Farrell with the Secretary of Labor.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority, by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Randa Krausner with us, Professor Krausner of the Booth School at Chicago as well. Randa, you and I can talk about the algebra standard error. Forget about it. Do we have any understanding of the veracity of our statistics given the new America, the new technology out there? Are we making this up as we go, or can we really guesstimate forward with some good faith?
I think we have reasonable insight into that. But of course, as you said, there are a lot of changes. Things are new. We're bouncing out of a very unusual period with COVID shutdowns. So of course, there's uncertainty that's there. But I think as we were talking about before, and as I'd said before, the Fed is going to keep at it until the labor market cracks. The labor market has not cracked. Wages are still going up at a very rapid clip. And the Fed can't stop until the labor market starts to slow down, because otherwise you're going to see wage inflation continue strong. You're going to see services prices continue to go up. And so they're going to keep at it. And as I said, I think they're going to keep at it till they get at least until the mid fives in the next year. And Jay is hoping, and he talked about this, what I call an immaculate disinflation. That is, could we bring the inflation rate down without having a significant rise in the unemployment rate? The only way they can do that is if wages start to come down, if more people come into the labor market, if demand starts to come down. We haven't seen that yet. So it doesn't look like an immaculate disinflation. Interest rates are going to have to continue to rise.
Fed Chair Jay Powell pointing to accelerated or brought forward retirements is a big driver of why we are not seeing the participation rate go back, why people are not coming back into the labor market. What did you make of his comments around that this week?
Well, I think, you know, that was his hope, that maybe if there's more supply coming into the labor market, that'll help to take some of the heat out of wages. Well, we're not seeing a lot of evidence of that now. And he was sort of hinting at, I was hoping for that, don't really seem to see it. So the only way that we can do this is to have slow down in demand. That'll slow down the demand for workers and slow down those wage increases. He's still hoping, but we've never had an immaculate disinflation before. I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's I think it's not very likely.
Randy Krausner with us, of course, of the Booth School of Chicago. In moments, Jeffrey Rosenberg will join us as well from BlackRock. We welcome all of you on radio and television of the shock of this jobs day. Futures at negative 61, as John Farrell mentions. Two-year yield exploding out. John, and a cup of coffee, a sip of Tang. We've gone from 14 basis points out to 17 basis points higher two-year yield.
Back to 440. Still below the highs of the week, but back to 440. And with yields up at the front end, Tom, as you can imagine, equities down, futures lower by 1.5% on the S&P, and the dollar stronger by about 0.7% on DXY.
To see this, folks, we're all wired in, but none of us is wired in like Michael McKee. He is looking there at the BLS data. I'm looking over just because I'm going to test. I'm going like this.
Trying to see what I'm looking at here.
What is the single data you see in the pages that you go through?
Well, I'm just trying to do the math here. The interesting thing about the hiring here is you might not be surprised that there were 20,000 construction jobs added. We've got a lot of rebuilding to do down in Florida. But what month is it? It's November, and we lost jobs in retailing, 30,000 jobs lost in retailing. That just seems very odd to me that we don't have as many people doing the retail work at holiday.
Is that
time.
Amazon? The cuts there by Mr. Josie?
It could be. I can go back and look here. One of the things you want to look at is the under transportation, warehousing, and couriers, and that couriers and warehousing were down 12.4 thousand. So at this point, it's kind of hard to see.
Amazon made a lot of hires in that world, but in the last couple of years,
yeah, I mean, but they don't seem to have added a lot of people. And that's kind of a little strange. You have to dig into that a little bit further.
We'll do that in about 20 minutes' time. Mike McKee's going to break down the jobs numbers for us as we go towards the opening bell. Then we're going to hear from this lineup. Fantastic lineup going into the Open. Mohamed Al-Erin of Bloomberg Opinion and a whole lot more. And Rick Rieder of BlackRock. Then we'll hear from Anastasia Amoroso of iCapital, Mike Collins of PGIM. And you'll hear from Sekri Walsh, Tom, responded to these numbers at about 9:45 Eastern time.
Maybe our most important conversation with the Secretary of Labor, given the railroad theatrics of America, harkening back to 1946 and 1877. Thank you so much, Randall Krosner, for being with us. We bring in, really at a telling point given bond market movement, Jeffrey Rosenberg joins us now from BlackRock. Jeff Rosenberg, I look at the volatility and I don't want to equate it over to the news on Bridgewater and their challenging fourth quarter. How do you run fixed income money right now? I don't have a clue.
Well, one of the biggest challenges is what we're seeing in the reaction to this surprise to the upside. And particularly, as you guys have highlighted, it's the wage data that's driving it. But what you see is stocks are down and bond yields are up. And that's the kind of correlation, a positive correlation in terms of both going down at the same time that is so challenging for All right. investors. And I think it's a reminder, what we learned from Chair Powell in the speech earlier this week is that the most important determinant for inflation going forward is going to be the services component. And what drives that services component is wages. And so what we might be starting to get a hint of here, and it was in a little bit of the earlier conversation, inflation's coming down because of all those underlying components, the supply side, the goods picture, the discussion around the lagged impact of housing. None of that matters. What matters is a wage price spiral. And so this upside surprise
here. You're going to bring that out today, Jeff?
what matters is this wage price and what we're seeing in the wages. And so I think that's the most important takeaway. And the challenge, to get back to your question, is that inflation really undermines the relationship between stock-bond correlations. Busted, we can't get back to that until we settle this.
I busted Jeff Rosenberg's chops. This is what happens when you study with Meltzer and good friend at Carnegie Mellon. You start talking about a wage spiral.
He has a point, though, Tom. Let me just jump in here quickly and tell you, I did the calculations. Private service industry jobs wages were up 0.8%, while goods producing jobs were up 0.4%. So what Jay Powell said about service industry jobs driving wages higher because they can't find employees is definitely showing up in the wage data, it appears.
Which composition really raises a question as well. And Randy Krosner, I'd love you weighing in on that, whether there's a compositional aspect where people on the higher ends are getting hired and there's a shortage, especially with the retirees. And on the lower ends, perhaps it's a different picture. What's your sense of how much that's contributing to the unexpectedly high rise in wage inflation? Jeff Rosenberg, what's your sense of that? Excuse me.
Sorry, I thought Randy might have been off, but I'll take that. You always have to look at the compositional effects here, and certainly there may be some of that, as Mike highlighted, with the retail numbers down and the warehouse numbers down, and Mike, some of that can be seasonal, so that's something we'll have to look in. So there is definitely, when you look at the high frequency data on a month to month basis, you can get a mix shift, and that may be pushing up this number, this 0.55 mm-hmm. number. Nevertheless. The bigger takeaway, if you smooth out from the monthly variations, is that the 12-month run rate of wage inflation is still above 5%.
Right.
And so this is really the challenge. And so we're going to get away at some point from this debate about 50 or 75 or really the pace. And the issue is the level of rates restrictive enough? That's really going to be the debate, because right now in the bond curve, the market is expecting rates to be cut by the second half of 2023. So there's a real disconnect between an expectation that we can see the Fed have success on inflation, so much so that they can turn and start cutting rates, versus what we're seeing in the data today, which is none of the impact. Now, there's long and variable lags here, so that's going to make it challenging. But the reality is, and that's what you're seeing in the reaction in the front end of the curve, is that we still have a significant inflation problem in the most important driver of inflation, right, which is in wages and services.
Jeff, I got eight ways to go here, and I'm going to do this in particularly with your heritage at Tepper and Carnegie Mellon. And the bottom line is, we've been here before. There's a belief out there by a lot of people that our financial world and maybe even our social world is going to fall apart with higher real rates, higher nominal rates, et cetera. That we've lived this before. We've been here before. What do you presume will we look like financially with a 5% Fed rate?
Well, we're seeing that right now in terms of some of the implications of a withdrawal of liquidity, which you've seen in the tech sector, which you're seeing in terms of some of the early stage venture and the impacts that has had and seen from a withdrawal of liquidity. And certainly in my markets, in the bond markets, the repricing from zero to a positive real interest rate, or certainly a positive nominal interest rate, with inflation staying sticky, it's hard to see the positive real interest rate, you know, is significant negative returns in fixed income. Now, the good news going forward is that adjustment from zero to the 400 basis point increases that we've seen this year is a one-time effect. And so the negative returns in fixed income are hard to repeat a second year going because you start with a lot higher income. So one of the positive aspects here, away from the significant challenges everywhere else in financial markets, is that cash has a yield associated with it. Whether that's a real yield after inflation depends on the outlook for inflation, but certainly there's a much better opportunity set in cash in the front end of the yield curve. And that helps to give a little bit of a place to hide while we see a lot of the implications of your question, a much higher nominal interest rate across financial markets, play out as it continues to play out.
Jeff, I'm just looking at market movements here and just the whipsaw that we've seen in the benchmark instruments like rates, like two-year yields up now 14 basis points. Now suddenly people gaming back out that 5% peak Fed funds rate. If we haven't seen a liquidity crisis yet, if we haven't seen a financial system accident, what's going to trigger it, given that we have seen such incredible volatility on the backs of some of these numbers?
Yeah, you know, we've seen sort of a rolling sequencing of kind of smaller fires. It's sort of like the analogy, small forest fires prevent large forest fires. So I think some of that is helping to ease some of the broader concerns. I think the other thing is that there's an anchoring to the global financial crisis as sort of the metric of what does a liquidity crisis look like. And that was a very particular one. Mm-hmm. And we've done a lot of things to mitigate that type of event from happening again. So the centerpiece of a liquidity crisis doesn't necessarily flow through the regulated financial markets. What we saw in the UK with the LDI crisis earlier this fall, is exactly this point. So you have seen some of those implications, and you know, I think we'll continue to right, see these kind of smaller forest fires as opposed to the big fire.
Jeff Rosenberg, thank you so much at BlackRock. Really, really appreciate it. Just a really exceptionally interesting and nuanced report to summarize not only the job statistic, better than good, better job formation, but the revision the same way as well.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Phosphine and I were talking, folks, about, you know, where we were on the jobs report, and the whisper number was quieter and da-da-da-da-da-da, and boom, seven people got it right.
Right.
And one of them was Tiffany Wilding. It's one of those days where Tiffany can lean back and go, I think I'll take the rest of the day off. She joins us right now. Tiffany, what did the Gloom crew get wrong? What did they get wrong about wage growth? And what did they get wrong about a two-month buoyant American job formation?
Well, I'm gonna be a little bit counterintuitive here, because the headline numbers were certainly very strong, but once I kind of popped the hood and looked under the details, I actually kind of got a little bit more worried. So one of the key things I think with this report that's kind of being missed is that the response rates were actually very low. They were the lowest that we've seen since the 90s, and that's
what's the response rate? That's so response she does that. She yeah. goes, "This yeah. is at Rhodes College when you do economics. This is what you do."
Exactly.
The response rate, just figure you can float right over. What's the response rate?
You care about the survey response rates, right? Because, you know, when people aren't responding to the survey, you're never really sure why. Is it because their establishment closed? Is it because they're away for the holidays? You know, what is exactly the reason? But what we found historically is that, like, when you see big drops in response rates, it can actually be an indicator of, turning points within the economy. And so I think that's what we're concerned about. This was the biggest drop in response rates, I think, that we've seen, you know, almost ever in the survey. And we are back down to 1990 levels. So, you know, although the headline number was really strong, you know, I think we are, you know, we're holding our breath a little bit, to understand how the revisions really work out when you see higher response rates. So I think that probably was increasing the wage data. We saw wages that grew much faster than expected. You know, it looked like there was some noise in the transportation sector in particular. There are other industry indicators within that sector that suggest that it's weakening quite a bit. So although we were encouraged by the headline numbers, you know, we're certainly, I think we're cautious still. And on top of all of that, you know, there's two surveys within within the report, and the household survey, it was also notably weaker. So, you know, again, I think we're seeing kind of mixed signals from this one, unfortunately.
So, but despite the mixed signals, Tiffany, how does, you know, a print like this impact your, I guess, just economic outlook in general, whether you have a recession call or not? It seems, yeah. I kind of feel like it's difficult to really talk about a deep recession when you got strong jobs numbers.
Yeah, that is absolutely for sure. The labor market, it does, and especially the payroll gains that we've seen, they have been incredibly resilient. But I would say the one thing here is that, you know, obviously the labor market, in terms of just the lags with which monetary policy works, the labor market is one of the, you know, in the later stages that you see it. You
okay.
obviously see it in the interest rate sensitive sectors first, which we're seeing, in housing and other, you know, business investment and structures and things like that. You know, and then it just takes time to get to the labor market. The other thing I would just note is, you know, historically, if you look, when you have payroll peaks before prior recessions, you know, for call it about 12 months, you have this kind of linear deceleration. You have a slow deceleration in payrolls, and then at some point, payrolls just kind of drop, you know, in a nonlinear fashion. And that tends to happen in every recession. So I, you know, although we're very encouraged by the fact that payrolls are very strong, you know, I think the historical lessons that you take is that, you know, you that doesn't mean that there can't be a nonlinear drop off in the future. So again, I think you have to be cautious.
Jeffrey Rosenberg shocked me so wonderfully. He helps us on the Fed Day, and of course on Jobs Day. He's at BlackRock, folks. And Jeff Rosenberg used a dreaded spiral word, the wage price spiral. Did you see a spiral in the wage statistics today where this month and last month average hourly earnings year over year were revised to a higher wage growth? Are we spiralish this morning?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there are increasing indications, right, that inflation is becoming more entrenched. That is for sure. And I think we, you know, that you can see it in the Atlanta.
Have you bought
Fed
a Christmas tree tracker. This week?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you're seeing it everywhere, right? And so I think that obviously is a really big concern from the Fed, and that's why we've seen such a rapid pace of Fed hikes. You know, and that, you know, economists kind of call it the hockey stick. You know, inflation kind of moves sideways until you get to this point where it really starts to accelerate, and we're in that kind of acceleration. And the Federal Reserve, you know, they need to tighten financial conditions. They need to really push on the economy, push demand down in order to get that under control. You know, we think that they are doing, you know, obviously we've seen them doing that, and we think that the moves that they've done so far, you know, will will help to moderate wage inflation. But again, the first thing you need to see is the labor market cooling off. Wage inflation is the last thing to come down, after you've come into recession. So, I think we're still monitoring the data and trying to understand how things are going. But I still think it's reasonable to think a recession's probably needed to get, inflation, back towards target here.
Have we said that before? Is that like a new... Did we used to pray for recessions, Tiffany?
No. And we called it, obviously Arthur Oaken in the 60s called it, the misery index, right? That added unemployment and inflation, because it's a very miserable situation that you have to be in as a central banker to push up unemployment in order to get inflation back down. But I guess the good news in all of this is, if the central banks are successful in doing that, I think their longer term outlook then is much better, right? Because you do, as they're saying, you do need price stability in order to, have a well-functioning economy in the long run.
So there's a thing, Tiffany, I'm in the camp of, economists that tell me it takes a while for these rate hikes to kind of really impact the economy. I'm kind of seeing that, inflation's peaked. It's rolling over in a lot of areas. We're starting to see the impact of these rising rates. It feels like the Fed can pause or at least slow down. But does a data print like today's jobs data maybe change that?
Yeah, I definitely think that today's data will increase doubt in the Fed's minds. If they were on track, I think they are on track to pausing still. You don't want to overreact to any one data point. But if you look at, just 6 month or 3 month moving averages of payroll gains, right, they're pretty resilient. So, I think the Fed's strategy here, though, is that we've done so much in so little amount of time. they're getting the Fed funds rate up to 5% in a little over a year. I mean, that is it at an extremely large amount of financial conditions tightening they've already done. So I think it is reasonable to say, let's just sit back and kind of see what happens to the economy, because we know things work through lags. But I do think the risk is that if the economy turns out to be more resilient, they could pause for a little while and then maybe even have to do more at some point.
Yeah.
And of course, that would be different from historical experience, where they pause and usually the next move is down.
The Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index, folks, is sort of like where it was before the report. I don't know, Tiffany. My head is spinning on this. Is Tiffany Wild, and she will help us here with PIMCO. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.